Welcome back to It's an Inside Job podcast. I'm your host, Jason Lim. Now, this podcast is dedicated to helping you to help yourself and others to become more mentally and emotionally resilient so you can be better at bouncing back from life's inevitable setbacks. Now, on It's an Inside Job, we decode the science and stories of resilience into practical advice, skills, and strategies that you can use to impact your life and those around you. Now, with that said, let's slip into the stream. Well, welcome back to another week of It's an Inside Job. I'm your host, Jason Lim. Have you guys been noticing lately that there seems to be an intensity, a ratcheting up of differences? You know, and this is at a cultural level. I mean, I see it nationally, I see it regionally, I see it religiously, politically. I mean, you could put almost any adjective to this, and it seems that we are being pulled to polar ends of different spectrums. And the usual conduits that can pull us together is discourse, it's discussion. But even that seems to be shut down. So this week I wanted to bring on a guest who can speak to cultural differences, these cognitive biases that we're all imbued with that allow us to see separation between us and other individuals, but also the bonding that we have with other people. You know, this tribal mentality per se. So today I am privileged and pleased to be joined by Dr. Catherine Wu. She's a teacher, a speaker, a cultural intelligence evangelist. She is a passionate advocate for cultural diversity and is currently working towards telling 10 million people about cultural intelligence through speaking, writing, and creating social media content. In 2022, she launched the Cultural Quotient podcast, the first podcast to grow cultural intelligence at work and in life. Now, as a speaker, Dr. Catherine frequently gives talks and conducts workshops on cultural intelligence for public and private organizations. She holds a PhD in leadership and cultural intelligence from the Center for Leadership and Cultural Intelligence in Singapore. She's French and she's lived in Asia for the past 18 years. So join me on this fascinating conversation I will have with Dr. Catherine now as we dive into the practicals and pragmatics to overcome these cognitive biases, to understand what cultural intelligence truly is and how we can increase our awareness about it, to increase the dialogue and the discourse, to help us bring us together, to see that maybe there are more things that we have in common than we have in different. So without further ado, this is my conversation with Dr. Catherine Wu. Well, welcome back to It's an Inside Job. Today I have Dr. Catherine Wu with me. I hope I pronounced your name correctly, Catherine.
Yes, perfect.
I was wondering, could we begin with a conversation by you introducing yourself to our audience and what you do?
Yes. So I'm a professor of cultural intelligence here in Singapore. So cultural intelligence, you may ask what that is. To make it very simple, is cross-cultural relations. And I teach people skills to adapt to work in environment where people come from all around the world. I live in Southeast Asia, in Singapore. I've been here for 14 years already. And this is a very... it's a very diverse part of the world. Singapore is very small. It's a city state with about 6 million people living here. And 40% of the workforce in Singapore come from outside of Singapore, which is one of these places in the world where it's almost impossible to have a career and live your life without at some point working with someone who come from elsewhere. As for me, I'm French, so I wasn't born in Singapore. I've been in Asia for 20 years and I first came many, many years ago, as a 23 year old who was dreaming to see the world. I first left France, for China. And originally I had this idea that I wanted to experience a culture shock. So I had studied abroad as a French. I had studied in England, in the UK. And it was challenging for me, mostly because of the language. But when I graduated, I decided that I wanted to help people adapt to other cultures. And how can I do that if I have never experienced a true culture shock? So I decided I would go to China, where I didn't know anybody. I didn't have a job. I could speak 12 words of Chinese, exactly. And I will tell you which they were. And then I went and I had my culture shock. I had many, I want to say. And I spent 4.5 years in China. And after that time, I decided that cross-cultural communication was my passion. I saw a lot of something very deep and important in helping people bridge the culture gap. And I wanted to study this more deeply to understand it better, not just at the superficial level of, you know, the French are like this and the Chinese are like that, but at a deep level as an individual, what are some of the skills I can learn so that I can be more open and more flexible and more accept better people who have very, very different way of doing things.
I think it's very interesting, especially considering how the world, you know, this may be very black and white, but, you know, when we watch the news, when we hear what's going on through our social media feeds, you can see this polarization. I mean, there's always been a degree of polarization, don't get me wrong, but it just seems much more excessive currently, even considering what has happened lately in the Middle East and how we get so pulled to each end of the spectrum, and cultural intelligence or cross-cultural communication is such a vital point right now. And to create resilient societies, you need an understanding. Again, this is my perspective. So perhaps we could begin by, what is cultural intelligence? Could you maybe simply operationally define it from your experience?
Cultural intelligence, the academic definition, is the capability of an individual to adapt to different cultures and different environment. Now, you know, I've been working in that space for about at least actively as an academic for 14 years, but I've been interested in this topic for much longer, and I've thought a lot about it. What does it mean, right? And I came to realize one thing is that, so traditionally, when we teach culture from an external outsider point of view. We describe other cultures. We say, okay, we are going to describe the Chinese culture. We're going to describe the French culture. And it gives a sense that culture is something static. And if only I can learn everything I can, you know, if I know all these things about other cultures, maybe I can just change the way I do things to adapt to them, right? But you and I, we've lived across cultures and we work with people from all around the world. And we know that it's a lot more complicated than that. I want to start back from how you framed that question. You say, you know, as the world is getting polarized and we see all these people pulling away. I think there's something in the human mind that creates segregations. Okay. We categorize, we see people as separate groups. We naturally associate with certain groups and separate from others. And this is our natural instinct. And all this bias, I mean, we can call this unconscious biases. They are hardwired. That's the way our brain works. Psychologists have established this. We know they happen across all around the world. It has nothing to do with your culture. It's just natural, right? We stereotype and we separate. Now, cultural intelligence is nurturing the skills or the ability to a certain extent, change the way we think about other people so that we don't fall back on those natural tendencies of our brain. So where we feel the urge to separate, with cultural intelligence, we can have the awareness of that our mind wants to make ourselves separated from another group. You know, we start stereotyping. Cultural intelligence is going to say, hey, now you're starting to stereotype. Can you see things differently, right? Instead of assuming that they are all the same, can we look at each person as an individual, get to know them individually? So cultural intelligence, the way in my experience, in my understanding is more like a set of, I like to call that habits of minds that allow us to bridge communities and relationship with people who are different from us, from who we would naturally prefer to dissociate, you know, to separate, because that would be more comfortable, that would be more of a human instinct.
I remember there was this one incident in the States, I think it was a couple of years ago, where a couple African gentlemen were in a Starbucks. African-American gentlemen were in a Starbucks, and one of the employees automatically assumed something that they should be. And the police came and kicked them out. And there was this uproar about this, which evidently is understandable. So yeah. Starbucks, you know, started this whole cultural sensitivity training for all their employees. But when you kind of look at the studies, all that investment in cultural sensitivity training in that sort of corporate environment, what it actually did, it didn't really change a lot. It may have with some individuals, but overall there was not a significant statistical difference. I was wondering, could you speak to this a little?
So I want disclaimer, diversity, DEI, you know, EDI, or this is not really my space. I think the way what I work with is most cultural diversity in terms of like international multicultural teams. Yeah. But what I can say about one reason why these trainings, they fail, is because they create a sense that one of the criticism has been that this kind of training on unconscious bias actually increase and amplify the stereotyping and the biases, right, in people. And that's because people become overly sensitive. And so then they have different reactions. One is like they compensate and then they completely shift to the other side, or they just prefer to stay away from all of this. Mm-hmm. And by staying away, then they end up, you know, separating even more from the community that they are supposed to get closer. And I think it's a natural productive mechanism. Now, as I say, I cannot speak specifically to this kind of training, but what I can tell from my experience of teaching cultural intelligence, because a lot of this, that's why I call this habits of minds. These are skills, but they are mental skills. So in order to train a mental skill, like a habit, it's a habit. You have to do this over a long period of time. And one challenge I feel that organizations have is this, you know, when you do a training, it's usually 1 day, 2 days. It's like it's very short and there is no reinforcement over time.
Exactly.
So it's very...
Yeah.
Right. So it's just one touch point that makes people feel very scared and uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Then they go back to, you know, their normal life. And suddenly, like, there is this big elephant in the room that was there already. But before that, we were not talking about it. So it was okay. Right. But suddenly there's the elephant and it's very visible. Mm-hmm. And now we don't know what to say. We don't know what to do, which reinforces a sense of discomfort. One of the assumptions I make is that it's not that the training don't work. It's just the format is not designed to create the outcome or the impact that it's supposed to create.
I think that's really well said, because a lot of these times when they have these cultural sensitive training, sometimes you think they're just putting a Band-Aid over the problem and they're not really addressing the cause of the wound. And what I hear you're saying is that cultural intelligence from your aspect, you know, the deeper dive, it's much more substantive, because what you do is become self-aware of these sort of these cognitive biases that are inherent in every human being. But what I hear you saying, it's over a long period. It's not just a patch, but you're constantly returning to it to build a habitual way of thinking. So the cognitive biases are over there, but you just become much better at becoming self-aware and the cultural sensitivities in that room, and to address it in a much more diplomatic way.
Yeah, that's right. So one of the quality of maybe I can give you some background on the research on cultural intelligence. The research on cultural intelligence started because, you know, some people said, okay, what's the difference between those people who adapt very well to other cultures? You know, you put them to any team and they always do really well and people love them and the team perform really well. And then you have these other people, they are really good, like in their country, for example, but then we send them to another country and they cannot adapt. You know, they cannot work. Nobody like them. So they started looking at what are some of the qualities. But historically, the research on intercultural competence was done by looking at, you know, the people, interviewing them and asking them, what do you do? Now, in cultural intelligence, the researchers, they took a different way, a different approach. They say, okay, what is the fundamentally, what is adaptability? And in psychology, adaptability is the definition of intelligence. When you have intelligence, when you're intelligent, you can adapt, right? We think of intelligence as the ability to solve problems, you know, to score highly on tests and stuff like that. But for social psychologists, intelligence is just your ability to adapt to the environment that you are in. And this laid the foundation of the theory of multiple intelligence because, you know, different type of environment are going to call for different type of adaptability, right? So if you are like, if you want to perceive the emotions of others in your environment, this is emotional intelligence. But it's not because you have a high IQ, like, you know, intellectual quotient, that you have high emotional intelligence. These are separate things. And then, you know, people who are very good at building connections, they have high social intelligence. And then you have all these different forms of intelligence. And at the time, it was in the late 1980s, early 1990s, there was, so this idea of multiple intelligence was starting to be explored. Emotional intelligence was starting to rise in, you know, in fame. And the, so the, this team of researchers, from Singapore, actually, they say, well, they look at all this intelligence. They say, is there a form of intelligence that determine a person's ability to adapt to other cultures, to environment where there is cultural diversity? And there was none. So they say, okay, fine. We're going to try it. We're going to define it this way. And then they went back to what's intelligence? And intelligence is, you know, how do we, what are some of the qualities that are associated with this ability to adapt, right? And there are three broad
determinants.
Like, area of determinants, yes, which is related to, so of course it's in the head. So the head, the cognitive element is very strong, right? I think when we think of intelligence, everybody thinks of the mind, right? Mm. We think about how much knowledge we have, how our ability to solve certain kind of problems. And then you have something related to your actions, your behavior. Like, how can you translate what's in your head into something that, you know, can help you, adapt, right? I mean, if you think of things like adapting to nature, you know, people who are really good at surviving in the wild, they can figure out how to create basic tools, basic, you know, shelter, like finding food. But you also need the ability to use your hands to craft the tools to do this. So that's one form of intelligence, but it's also translate this idea. I mean, it's also give you the idea that what's in your head has to be translated in some form of something that you can do with your hands. And then there's also another element that they brought in, which is the motivation, the drive. You need to, it's not enough to have a lot in your hand and to can do it. You need to want to do it. So they define cultural intelligence as a combination of these three or four broad sets of capability. And then they look more deeply and they started exploring how people who adapt to other cultures, how do they solve problems? And one thing that they do, like what you say, it's not like they don't have biases or unconscious bias. It's not like they don't stereotype or, you know, they don't judge or things like that. But when they do, they are better at catching themselves. So they will stereotype. They will say, oh, you know, people in that group, they are all like this. And then they will say, no, I shouldn't be saying that, right? I realize it's a thought I have, but I shouldn't be saying it. I should adjust and I should adapt. And it's the same with, you know, when we have this tendency to jump to conclusion. We see something, we make up a story very quickly, right? So people who have that quality of cultural intelligence, they will be like, okay, wait a minute. I don't have all the information. I need to look, you know, more broadly and try to make sense of what's going on here. So it's this ability to, I call this the slow mind. It's the ability to slow down your thinking. That's why I feel like we need to have training. You know, those skills, some people will acquire them naturally through their upbringing because, well, partly because it's their personality, but also partly that they have that chance to be engaged in those very diverse environments and so on. But most people don't. Like, most people don't have the experience. And it's very, very hard to imagine, you know, to see from the perspective of somebody else or to move away from those blinders that our mind naturally have without, on our own, right? So to bring it back to the unconscious bias, you know, yes. training, is this is fundamentally, you know, the ability, like the skills of cultural intelligence is to train people to think in a new way, in a different way. And this cannot happen if it's just a one-time intervention. You need to have repeated reinforcement.
You said you work with a lot of international teams and such. So, you know, that would speak evidently to, let's say there's 10 people in the room, they're all part of the same team, they're coming from different regions. But mm-hmm. with that, you have obviously a handful of different cultural norms, and those cultural yes. norms can be quite significant or very little.
Yeah.
But what do you do to help a team move from sort of their own individual cultural norms to find some sort of team norm? So which they can collaborate and communicate.
So naturally, culture is, I want to say, is the default when there's no other habit or option. So first of all, it depends on what the team is, what the team has to do. So in teams that are diverse, there are two conditions that usually need to be met. The first one is there need to be a very strong alignment on what the team is trying to do. Why are we here? And what is it that we need to work on together that we cannot do on our own? Mm. So this is what brings team together, right? And once we have a very strong why as a team, then the next condition is to have a lot of clarity of what we need to do to achieve that why. Now, when in the what we need to do, it can mean different things. It can mean obviously what's the job that we have to do, what's the task, what's the end goal. Mm-hmm. But it's also about the how we're going to get there. In terms of, you know, can we create a new way of communicating in our team?
Yes.
Can we create a new way of, you know, organizing the work? Because when the norms are very clear and people know, you know, what is the way we communicate in this team, the way we organize the work and things like that, they are less likely to fall back to their natural preferred way of doing things, which is usually their culture. So typically what I've seen in multicultural teams, they are different. When you say, you know, when people come from all around the world, they have different norms. But typically there are two norms that really cause a lot of tension. One is related to the communication. And this is also associated to this. It's the communication, but it's influenced by the power structure in the team. So cultures usually that are used to very hierarchical structure of decisions, right? A team will naturally have a leader. And the leader is going to tell us what to do. Also, people would expect the leader to tell them when to talk. So there is less the communication is more passive, is more assertive. And it's interesting because I work in Asia. So I work with a lot of teams made of people from Asia who also yes. have to work with people in other parts of the world. And one story I often hear is people being passed up for promotion because they wanted to be promoted or they wanted to be reassigned, reallocated to a job in Europe, for example. And the boss say, sorry, but you know, we never hear your voice. You are not leadership material, right? And part of it is because of the norms of communication in Asia generally, when people have a strong respect for authority and they are less likely to promote themselves and to be assertive in their communication. So that creates a lot of tension. The other one is related to, you know, things like time and deadline, how strict should we be on the time, idea related to perfection, how well do we need to work? How perfect should things be? How much work do we need to put in? In some cultures where perfection is really important, people work really hard. In some other cultures where it's more like, okay, you do your best, but you know, then there is also more flexibility. So that creates a lot of tension. So I think what's really important to do is to get to to align and create some norms from the beginning. Now, the norms don't have to be aligned with any culture in particular. But if they are, then there needs to be some recognition that not everybody enter the team at the same level. So, and that's why we talk about more inclusive norms. And back to my point about communication, an inclusive way, an inclusive norm for communication is to not to expect everyone to speak up whenever they have an idea and a thought, because most people in the world really won't do that, because most cultures in the world actually are more hierarchical with a higher, more expectations that you have to wait for your turn in order to speak. And if you are not invited, you know, you just don't speak. So in my experience, I mean, when I've seen teams, and teams that work really well are usually teams that have very strong, strong norms for getting everybody's inputs. It's very strict and very structured, and it's something that is enforced by the leader over and over again. And generally it has two steps. The first one is we always speak in turn, so everybody is invited to speak. So we hear everyone. And the second thing is the most junior member in the team always speak first. Because again, when the hierarchy is high, people who are more junior will have a tendency to agree with a more senior. So whatever good idea that they will have, they won't feel comfortable speaking up if somebody else more senior has already spoken. So it's these two things, you know, speak in turn and always start with a more junior person.
You know, what I like about it, it's very pragmatic. It's very practical. It's very skill-based. And what it sounds like also at the same time, this is something that has to be constantly encouraged. And you have to constantly return to it and sort of underscore the importance of this. Because as you said, you know, myself, I come from a cross-cultural family. My father was Chinese and my mom was British. Yeah. And, you know, just if we bring it down to the black and white, you know, the Chinese side of my family, they wouldn't just dive into the topic. It would be a little of a socialization around things, a little more small talk and get it to it. My mom's side, it was just to get straight to the point. Now, this is just a family, but you can understand the complexities that would bring to a business, especially if a business has to move forward, has to meet deadlines. You know, as you said, some cultures, they have kind of, you say 3 o'clock, but for them, it could be 5 o'clock, right?
Yeah.
And it's setting that and making that evidently clear. This is what we need. And as you said, setting team norms and then obviously reinforcing those norms.
Yeah. And I think what's really important in teams, especially when there is diversity. So the main challenge with diversity is when there is a power imbalance. So in a team, you know, like people should not perceive that their norms are seen as inferior and somebody else's norms are superior. So when we fix team norms, they have to be the team norm. It's about the team. It's not about one group, you know, imposing their view on the other. And I think that's really important. I mean, I've seen teams that work remotely from their entire lifespan, you know, teams that were created even before the pandemic, where leaders were very intentional about building those remote collaborations, international collaborations.
Yes.
And what was really fascinating about this is the intentionality behind the team norms. And the norms were not created, they did not emerge like naturally or spontaneously. Because if you let the norms emerge naturally, usually what will happen is the norms will be more aligned with the most vocal, the more assertive, the more dominant members of the team. And generally, these are the cultures, you know, in Europe, in North America, that are more vocal and more domineering, which then if you set this as a norm for the team, creates a lot of resentment in the other team members from other cultures who feel that they can keep up because, you know, they are not used to it. It's too difficult. And anyway, even if they try, they are at a disadvantage because they don't have the same experience and familiarity. So in those teams I have seen that work really well, actually the teams sit down together and intentionally they create norms for the team. So those norms are not associated with another a culture or, you know, any one background, but they are specifically designed for the team to work together. And the question is, if we want to function well as a team, as a multicultural team, considering our cultural differences and background, what do we need to do, right? What is the best way for all of us to communicate, to organize the work, to set deadlines? It's like creating a team charter or a team contract from the beginning and then revisiting this over and over. But this is, it sounds like something very simple or almost like, you know, why do we even do this? Why do we bother? But the idea is to minimize the tension that comes from a perception of having less power. Because one thing I have observed, you know, when I hear stories, when I watch people, especially because I'm in Asia and generally in Asia, people are more reserved in their communication, especially in team when people are there. People feel that they are at a disadvantage. They feel like they can't compete, you know. These people, they don't leave me any room to speak. I have ideas, but I cannot find a space to say my piece. And then, you know, there's always somebody else that get promoted before me, that get more opportunities. They don't work better than me, but they are just more vocal. They are more social. They do some of those things that we don't do. And that creates resentment. So to sit together and have a discussion around what is the best way for us to communicate in order to achieve our goals, remove that sense of, you know, like power imbalance, and somehow give everybody an even footing, you know, in the team.
Cultural intelligence is the ability to adapt to different cultures and environments when interacting with people from diverse backgrounds. It involves overcoming natural tendencies to stereotype and separate from other cultural groups, helping individuals see each person as an individual rather than clumping them together. Cultural sensitivity training can sometimes backfire by increasing stereotypes and biases, as it may make people overly sensitive or lead them to avoid engaging with different communities. It requires consistent training and reinforcement to become a habit of mind. And adaptability is a key component of cultural intelligence, encompassing thoughts, beliefs, behaviors, and the motivation to adopt new perspectives. Now, in the context of multicultural teams, Catherine suggested that the goal is to shift international teams away from relying on their cultural norms and towards establishing their own team norms. To achieve this, she says, two key conditions must be met: a strong alignment regarding the team's objectives and a clear understanding of the requirements to achieve those objectives. When working with diverse teams, challenges often arise in communication style, deadlines, and the quality of details. To foster inclusivity, well, the important thing, she says, is to intentionally create communication norms, such as everyone speaking in turns, and the most junior team member speaking first to reduce power imbalances, and to ensure a more equitable and collaborative team environment. This intentional approach, well, it prevents the dominance of assertive team members and promotes a fair and inclusive team dynamic. Such a fascinating part one, while part two is just as engaging. So let's slip back into the stream in part two with my conversation with Dr. Catherine Wu. So let me ask you, I've been assuming this is like a mixed bag of different cultures we've been talking about, but let's say there is a team that there is a majority culture and there's a couple of team members that are minority cultures.
Yeah.
And you do as much as you can, but the majority culture will tend to dominate. I mean, how much responsibility and ownership comes down to the minority cultures on that team to have to just step up, right? And, you know, put aside the resentment or feeling offended, and where they just have to step up. So if it is, let's say, a Western culture, and it is, you know, everyone who you're a part of the team. So if you're sitting at the table, you're just expected to speak up. And this is communicated in a very direct diplomatic way over time to set these team norms. But how much does it actually come back down instead of the majority bending always to the minority, that the minority has to just sort of step up their game?
I think it depends on the team and the context. So, you know, if you are And so if you come to Singapore, for example, and you work in a company where more people are from Singapore, naturally, you are a minority. There is an expectation that the minority will adapt to the majority. So, I mean, I think you know, there is, I get the idea of like, there is a level of inclusivity that we want to have, which is nice ideally, but the reality is when you go to another country, when you have to adapt because the, it's back to this idea of power imbalance. The power imbalance is too strong and it's not in your advantage as a the minority. The difference, but that would be different if we are talking about a global team, like assuming that, you know, you and I work together on a project and we have collaborators, you know, in the Middle East and in Japan and, you know, in other countries, then it's a different story because we all come more or less, you know, we come from different culture, but there is no dominant, like the context is more equal, like we all come in with our strengths and so there is less pressure to adapt one way or another. And even if there were, you know, there is less reason or justification for it. So I think the context of the team is really important.
Because I think that's an important, because that can create a lot of controversy when you have a mixed bag of cultures. Then it's, I think it's, as you said, it's a, maybe a little easier to set more team standards where there is not one sort of dominant things. But for example, as a Canadian moving into Norway, when I work with Norwegian companies, I don't expect them to do everything like Canadians do. Right?
Yeah.
Me being one of 10 people and the rest, let's say, are Norwegian, regardless of their ethnicity, but Norwegian, let's say the Norwegian mentality, and then I have the Canadian mentality, the onus comes down to me to adapt to that culture, right? I can't constantly feel offended or constantly feel that I'm pushed aside. At some point, I have to, you know, take responsibility and ownership and step up to that team, right? I need to adapt to this majority culture. And I think sometimes that's where the controversy comes across the board, where maybe there's too much focus on people's sensitivities, too much sometimes, right? And that makes us very brittle and fragile as a team or as an organization, at least from my perspective, working with different teams and organizations here.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I agree with you. You know, I lived in China for 4.5 years.
Yeah.
I worked for Chinese companies. I don't think, I mean, generally in that context, people will be a little bit more flexible towards me because they cannot expect me to behave like, you know, a Chinese. But still, that requires some adaptation. But I think that's also why, originally the research on cultural intelligence started with a question, what's the difference between people who can adapt very well and, you know, wherever you put them, they always adapt, and the ones who don't, right? there is also a certain level of flexibility that is something that, I mean, partly is personality, partly is something that we can learn and we can train. And I think one of the thing I have observed, you know, like with working with a lot of people from all around the world is generally the, and I think that bring it back to the, this idea of unconscious bias and habit of mind, is that people who struggle, usually they take the cultural behavior that they don't understand, they take them personally. So they don't realize it's culture. They think it, they assume it's directed at them because of something that they have not done or done or something about them. Recently I heard the story of, it was an international student from an African country, and he was struggling, coming to Singapore. And then I heard from his friend who told me the story, and his friend is from India, and he took my course. And he said, you know, my friend, he is really having a hard time. And he said that, Asians are the problem and they don't like him. And, you know, the, and so I listened to his problems, and then, you know, one day he comes and he has a problem with a Filipino. So I tell him, go and read about Philippine culture. And then the next day he comes and he has a problem with a Japanese, and I tell him, okay, learn about the Japanese. But, you know, that student of mine from India, he said, but after a while, I realized that actually the problem is not Asians. The problem is my friend, right? It's my friend who thinks that those behaviors that are different from his cultures, he thinks is because, you know, they don't say hi to him, for example, when they meet him. They say, he thinks it's because they don't like him, but they don't say hi to me either. He said, no, it's cultural. It's just that he doesn't understand that it's a cultural behavior. And I call that the center of the world syndrome. It's this idea that it's ethnocentrism, right? It's this belief that we have that the way we think, feel, and, you know, and the thing that we want, everybody else think, feel, and want the same, right? And we judge others by our own cultural standards. And when we go to other culture, we don't realize actually things don't work like this over there. We continue to judge them based on what we know. That's why we go to other cultures and we say, oh, these people, they lack self-confidence, or these people, they are unprofessional, or these people, they are incompetent, because we don't realize that, you know, their behaviors are not driven by the same things. They don't have the same motivation and priorities. I mean, you mentioned this about your parents, but we continue to judge them by what we know. So there's the example of a colleague, and she worked for an international company, and she was telling me, you know, when she goes to Europe, people tell her that, you know, you have to assert yourself, you have to be more of a leader. And when she comes, because apparently she said that she's not vocal enough and things like that. And then, you know, when she comes to Asia, people say, you know, you are too strict, you are too tough as a leader. So depending on where she is, the same person will be judged differently by different people, who don't realize that actually the way they judge her has nothing to do with leadership capability or being professional or unprofessional. Instead, it's based on their own cultural programming and expectations. And I think that's one of the main reasons why people who find it difficult to adapt to different cultures, they struggle, because they cannot extract themselves from this center of the world syndrome. They continue to judge others in the same way as what they are used to. And whereas when you go to another culture, you have to throw away whatever you know and learn new standards, because whatever has worked for you in another country is not going to work exactly the same in this new environment.
I think that's so well said. You know, considering that, sort of what tips would you give my listeners if they want to begin developing this sort of their cultural intelligence, let's say on a daily, if not weekly basis, even if they're not directly involved in let's say a diverse or a cultural work environment, but they still want to do that because maybe they would like to eventually work in an international firm or college or an international team?
For me, the simplest thing you can do is every time you catch yourself looking at a person and say, you know, they are so unprofessional. I think it's the basic, so unprofessional. And if that person is from another culture than you, I want to say, stop for a moment and ask yourself, you know, what if it's their culture, right? And my friend Vanessa Barros, she wrote a book on professionalism. Actually, this idea of professionalism is based on her dissertation work, where she interviewed 200 executives, and she studied how they resolve cross-cultural conflicts. And she found that when people don't understand the cultural differences, they judge people as unprofessional. And what she said, she did, well, you know, whenever you feel like another person is unprofessional, ask yourself, if I think you are unprofessional, what do you think of me? Do you think I am professional or unprofessional? You know, because our idea of professionalism are fundamentally grounded in our culture. Culture, not only our national culture, but our culture in terms of our experience in different organizations, in different professions. You know, our professional education and all of this also has trained us to have a certain standard of, you know, what is professional behavior. But when we try to put ourselves in the shoes of others and see it, you know, if I see you are unprofessional, do you think I am professional? You know, does that make me professional in your eyes? Because the problem is this ethnocentrism, the center of the world syndrome. We only see others through our own eyes, but we almost never think about or stop to ask ourselves how other people see us, right? So my advice to the listeners is, next time you catch yourself, like, first catch yourself thinking so unprofessional, so incompetent, ask yourself, could there be something, could this have to do with their culture?
I think that's very interesting because I was working with a Norwegian company and they had rented, they're sort of a maritime, they work with vessels and such, and they had rented one of their vessels to Japan and to the Japanese government. And the Japanese government used it for the purposes that they need. Mm. And they crewed it with Japanese. But the Norwegians were there as engineers and helping sort of crack problems. And so when something came up as a challenge, you know, the Norwegians would just tend to adapt. They would make a call based on what they had to do and solve the problem. The Japanese, on the hand, again, a cultural thing, they had to, you know, kick it up the ladder to get approval. And that had to get kicked up the ladder and then down, right? And so there's no right or wrong, but you can see where one culture is more of the collective to try to find a way of solving this problem. Evidently, it took more time, where the Norwegians in this case said, okay, yeah, it's this, and they made the call, they just decided on what they had to fix, right? Yeah. There was a shorter chain of communication and thus resolving the issue. But that's not to say that's the best way or the only way. Hmm. This is where I can see, you know, when you have two dominant cultures and they're trying to collaborate to create some sort of business or collaboration together, where this is even another dimension where you have two dominant cultures that are quite different, but they want to work together, right?
Yeah. And I think the challenge in the case that you just shared is that I imagine from the Norwegian, this is very frustrating having to wait for the Japanese to go through up and down the ladders, because this is going to take a long time, right? Mm. So in the meantime, they probably have some additional costs and delays and other implications of it. So the challenge of these cross-cultural conflicts and differences is they also create a lot of frustration. And then because we're frustrated, we say, you know, like, this is so inefficient and this is... And I feel like one thing that I teach people is, you know, having those judgments is not going to help you very much. And instead, we just have to recognize that culture is what it is. It may not be good or bad. Maybe it's not always good and it's not always bad. But it's just the way it is. The Japanese, that's how they're going to make decisions. Mm. It's not because the Norwegian are going to push that they're going to change that, right? So these are things that we have to accept and we have to learn to deal with. So the other day I was talking to a manager and we were, you know, I said, you know, but what's the big deal with culture after all? You know, why do we, I mean, for me, it's a big deal because it's my job, it's my life and my career, right? But for most people, it's just like, yeah, okay, whatever, right? I'm like, why do we need to think of culture? And that manager told me, somebody who worked in a very international environment for years, and he told me, you know, for me, thinking of culture keeps me sane. He says some days, sometimes, so some situation can be so frustrating. I can become so angry at what's happening in front of me because of whatever reason. And having that thought in my head to say, it's not them, it's the culture. It's just the way people do things here. He said that helps me calm down and, you know, find solutions, right? Mm. Give me the mind space to find the solutions. And I thought that was a very nice way to explain it, because it's just the way I see it is culture is just a fact of life. And we have different priorities, we have different preferences and different way of doing things. And, you know, I mean, we can get angry, we can, you know, become frustrated or impatient. We can only change ourselves, right? We cannot change others and the way they think and do things. So, yeah, back to the Japanese and the Norwegian, I think the value of thinking of culture is like when the frustration is there, thinking is a culture. It's an external thing that, you know, it's like, it's a weather. I cannot do anything. I can complain about the weather all I want. I'm not going to change it. So it's the culture.
But I think the frustration itself can be a good thing because it's a signal where things need to be communicated. The subject needs to be breached. And this question is, okay, you know, you're X culture, we're Y culture. We see that we have, This creates tension between us. How can we address it? Can we create some sort of collaboration norms that are neither culture X or Y. And, you know, we talk about it. So when you see the frustration, we can actually define the frustration. Okay, this is a touch point. This is a sensitive touch point, a pain point. But how can we address it? Because this is going to come up again and again and again. And so I think by, as you said, it's just being aware. Sometimes our cognitive biases, the frames we may throw on people, the stereotypes we may use, whatever, right? But I think that frustration or that irritation or that agitation allows us to say, you know what? Okay, here's a place where we can build a bridge. How can we do this? So, because we know this is going to come up again. And how do we deal with it so it's not as frustrating?
I think this is a great point, Jason, because, you know, you asked me about what is cultural intelligence. And I told you it is awareness and this habits of mind. But actually, there is another element to it. And this is something that, it started with research in psychology has found that people who are bicultural or multicultural or who have been exposed to other cultures tend to be more creative. They have more cognitive complexity and they are better at reconciling opposites or things that apparently look incompatible. And I think that's the point I'm trying to make, right? It's like, okay, fine. You know, there's John Vision and the Japanese and they have very different way of doing things. And of course, the first time, they're going to go back to their cultural way, right? But if they keep working together and if truly they can develop the skill of cultural intelligence, then at one point they may see new opportunities, you know, they may learn from each other,
exactly,
right? Because when we work together, when we are in a diverse environment, it's not just that, oh, I stick to my culture, you stick to yours, right? Where we live for a long time in another culture, when you grow up in a bicultural, you know, between two parents who are very different cultures, you don't just become one or the other. You actually embrace, you know, absorb some of it and you become this melting pot of culture where you don't really identify anymore to one culture or the other because somehow you have adopted some of the habits of everywhere. So that's in the development, you know, the first encounter with another culture is confusing and it's frustrating because it sends us back to our own center of the world's idea, right? But for those people who can persevere and keep doing it, the ones who do well are the ones who actually become better at, they don't just adapt in the sense of completely changing themselves. They adapt by embracing new ways that they learn and they grab from other cultures. So there's this level of integration. And this is something that actually I teach my students. We do a lot of conflict resolution training. And one thing that we learn to do is to embrace something called polarities. You know, if you are a Norwegian that is super flexible and very, you can make decision like right on the spot. Mm. Whereas you're working with Japanese who have to go back to the hierarchy and check everything very carefully before they can make the decision. And on the surface, it looks like very, polar opposites. But actually, if you think about it, both ways have pros and cons, right? Mm. So truly cultural intelligence is, as a manager of that team, how can you leverage, you know, the positive of both so that you can create something that is much better than just a team of Norwegian or just a team of Japanese? And that is when diversity, you know, that's where you can really reap the benefit of diversity. But that requires people in the team who are willing to go beyond their own way, to accept that others have different ways, and to start seeing the positive in the very strange or different way that other people do things and create something new, you know, is this co-creation of a new way that really make those diverse teams, the one that are really fantastic, they are the one who can really embrace all these apparent contradictions and turn this into something that is new. Right.
That's very well articulated. And it hits home the point for, you know, many of my listeners. They work in multicultural or international teams and organizations, or whether they're in school too. I mean, a lot of schools have such diverse populations now. That's so important. We're coming close to the top of our conversation. Is there any last tips or suggestions you would like to leave with my listeners, Catherine?
I don't have... like tips that's going to solve big problems. But what I want to tell people, and, you know, take the time to learn about people from other cultures. If you have a colleague who is from a very different culture than you, just take the time to have lunch and become interested and curious. Because at the end of the day, all these things, you know, all these mental skills and mental habits that I have mentioned, we have discussed today, you don't learn them like, you know, it's not like a 5 minutes thing. There's no tip that's going to make you think like this. It's about being exposed and, you know, taking the time and to be curious and open. And it's really in the contact, you know, having all these opportunities. And sometimes when we work with other people, we are so into the work, into the task. We don't learn to see them as individual. So I would say, you know, it's not just about work. It's about getting the person more deeply. And this has very deep, immediate implication from understanding how people work and how we can relate with them in professional context.
Well, Dr. Catherine Wu, Catherine, thank you very much for spending some time with me on It's Inside Job today. It was a fascinating discussion. I mean, we could have talked another hour, I'm sure, on all the different, we could have found all these little niches to explore when you talk about culture, because it's so diverse, it's so complex, and there's so many moving parts to it. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Jason.
The second part of my discussion with Dr. Catherine Wu serves as a cautionary tale, highlighting the danger of assuming that everyone thinks, feels, and behaves like we do, a phenomenon she refers to as the center of the world syndrome. Catherine emphasizes the importance of adaptability, which involves changing our beliefs and building an understanding of new culture from scratch. Understanding different cultures helps us to be more present with our own beliefs and the meanings we assign to situations. Additionally, being aware of cognitive biases allows us to override them and to foster empathy for those with different perspectives. We also talked about the pain points, the frustration that sometimes arises when two cultures are trying to achieve a common goal. Now, the concept of using frustration as a signal to address and find solutions to cultural clashes, well, it underscores the importance of establishing team norms for constructive dialogue and discourse in multicultural teams. Ultimately, the message is clear. Cultural intelligence involves continuous self-awareness, adaptability, and the ability to connect with others across cultural boundaries. So I'd just like to send a personal thank you to you, Dr. Catherine Wu. Catherine, for joining me today and sharing your insights and your experience with us. I think it goes a long way to help us bridge the gaps that are too expansive right now. So thank you. If any of you would like to reach out to Dr. Catherine Wu, I will leave all her contact information in the show notes. Well, thanks for joining me for another week and allowing me to be part of that week. If you have any questions, any feedback, any comments, please share them. Send them my way. I'm always open to hearing from you guys. And if you would do me a kind favor and share this podcast, ask people to subscribe and to rate this podcast, you'd be doing me a huge solid as to spreading the word. And until the next time we meet, the next time we continue this conversation, keep well, keep strong, and we'll speak soon.